You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Canada stands with Ukraine. Ukraine is our friend and ally. Ukraine is like us. They are a democracy fighting for their sovereignty and for their freedoms, including freedom of the press, against a hostile, despotic invader who respects none of those liberties. And as Ukraine fights Russia for their freedoms, Canada is sending over money and weapons and journalists. But Ukraine tried to send one back. Last month, the Globe and Mail reported that Anton Skiba, their photojournalist in Ukraine, applied to the Ukrainian government to have his press credentials renewed, and he was denied. Ukrainian security services accused him of holding a Russian passport. They demanded that he take a lie detector test, and they questioned whether his work as a journalist for the Globe and Mail was aligned with Ukraine's national interests. This was not an isolated incident. Last year, Ukrainian security, the SBU, sent a list of names to their friends in the FBI. The SBU explained to the FBI that this was a list of people who they suspected of spreading fear and disinformation about Ukraine through their Twitter accounts. Ukraine asked the FBI to get Twitter to remove these people's accounts, basically to censor them. One of the names on that list was Aaron Mate, a Canadian journalist who works for the website Grey Zone. And those two Canadian examples, those are just two cases of many that challenge the notion of Ukraine as a country that respects press freedom. Ukraine has also revoked press credentials for a reporter from the New York Times after the Times reported on Ukraine's use of cluster bombs. They revoked the access of an NBC reporter who entered Crimea from Moscow, and they did it again to a reporter from CNN, and two reporters from domestic Ukrainian outlets. Now, in some cases, as with the Globe and Mail's reporter, they later reinstated credentials after political pressure was applied. And other times, they didn't. Now, information is often tightly controlled during wartime, and it is not surprising that Ukraine forbids reporters from reporting on things like the location and numbers of military personnel or details about combat operations. But more concerning are ideological crackdowns on content which, in their opinion, promotes or justifies Russia. Last May, the group Reporters Without Borders issued to Ukrainian President Zelensky an 8-point roadmap for strengthening press freedom in Ukraine. Here's point one. End arbitrary restrictions and discrimination with regard to media covering the war. Doesn't seem to have worked. Just last month, The Intercept reported that Ukraine retaliated against journalists who defied press restrictions by reporting from the liberated city of Kherson and revoked their credentials. It's wild, a New Yorker reporter was quoted as saying, how little of what is happening is being chronicled. And the main reason is that the Ukrainian government has made it virtually impossible for journalists to do real frontline reportage. So yes, Ukraine is a democracy. But Ukraine is also a country at war, a country under martial law, where things like press freedom and free elections are on hold. Today, we are going to dare to ask some questions about how free our ally Ukraine really is. We are going to speak with the two Canadian media journalists who were sanctioned by Ukraine, Grey Zone's Aaron Mate and the Globe and Mail's Anton Skiba. And thanks to our colleague Sarah Larniuk, reporting from Ukraine, we are going to get answers from the Ukrainian government, from the Ministry of Culture and the Ministry of Defense, respectively. Wait for it. Aaron Mate is a Canadian-born journalist and writer who has worked for The Nation, Al Jazeera, and Democracy Now. He currently writes for The Gray Zone, which calls itself a website dedicated to investigative reporting on empire. Others have called it a far-left, even a fringe publication. Mate spoke to me from his home in Brooklyn. I started by asking him about the FBI's attempt to get him censored from Twitter because Ukraine asked them to.
In March 2022, the FBI sends Twitter a note on behalf of the SBU, which is Ukraine's main intelligence service. And the FBI says that we've received this list of Twitter accounts from the SBU, and the SBU says that these accounts spread fear and disinformation, and this list is for you to review. And in the attached list, which is, you know, authored by the SBU, Ukraine's main intelligence agency, it's a list of accounts, and Ukraine says basically to Twitter, please suspend these accounts and also provide us with their user information. And there's more than 100 names on the list, and including me. I'm on there. And Twitter responds by saying, okay, we'll review these accounts, but just so you know, we can see already that there's Canadian and American journalists on here, for example, Aaron Mate. And unless you can show us that there's some sort of deceptive tie between these people and a foreign government, we're not going to go after journalists. And the FBI says, okay, well, whatever you think is appropriate. But it took Twitter to tell the FBI that they were trying to censor journalists and to point out that that's not an appropriate thing to do. And we know about all this because this is a part of the Twitter files, which is the trove of leaks that have emerged from Twitter in recent months. And so I obtained this portion of that trove, and this is what I reported. This dynamic where you have the FBI passing on a censorship request at the behest of a foreign intelligence service, it raises the question of, like, what law enforcement and public safety function does that serve? Like, how is it in the public's interest to ban people from Twitter, including journalists? And does this violate First Amendment rights? I mean, I think it does. Now, I'm trying to take the best spin on this here for the FBI, which is that I don't think the FBI got this list from its counterparts in Ukraine, looked it over, saw me, for example, and said, yes, let's get him suspended. I just think that they were doing this because the U.S. support for Ukraine is so deep right now because, you know, in my opinion, Ukraine's being used for a geostrategic purpose to basically sacrifice itself to bleed Russia, which is the U.S. main rival. So as part of that, cooperation between these two states is so extensive that the FBI is willing to just blindly pass on censorship requests like this without vetting them themselves. That's my assumption, is that this wasn't vetted. And I asked the FBI. I asked the special agent personally who passed on this request. And I also asked the FBI headquarters, you know, did you vet this list before you passed it on? And when Twitter told you that the FBI was effectively trying to censor journalists, has that prompted any review or reconsideration of your policy of collaborating with Ukrainian intelligence on matters like this? And the FBI said, thank you for your questions, but we can't confirm or deny the veracity of our correspondence, so we're not going to comment on your questions. So I haven't gotten an answer, which means that for all I know, this collaboration is still going on.
Why do you think you were targeted by the SBU for spreading fear and disinformation and being contrary to the war effort?
I've been critical of the proxy war in Ukraine. But the things I point out, I don't think are particularly radical. And nothing I say, I think, could ever justify censoring me, no matter what my views are. But for what it's worth, I've never supported Russia's invasion. I've been critical of it. I don't think it was justified. What I've tried to do is point out that there's a context. And I've tried to provide some background to that, to my audience. And I've tried to point out that, you know, things you could easily say before Russia invaded. So, for example, before Russia invaded, you know, Barack Obama was talking about how it wasn't worth having a war with Russia over who rules eastern Ukraine. And it was widely reported in the Western media that Ukraine had a neo-Nazi problem inside its armed forces, and that U.S. officials had long raised concerns about NATO expansion going to Russia's borders and how that could possibly trigger a war. And after Russia invaded, it all of a sudden became very, very difficult to say those things in public in the West. But I kept saying them. And I think that's probably explains why I was marked for censorship here by Ukraine, because they don't like having these things pointed out.
So that's from my conversation with Aaron Maté. Now, I knew when I was speaking to him that this is a controversial guy. His website, The Gray Zone, is constantly facing accusations from Foreign Policy magazine, from The Daily Beast, that they are pro-Kremlin, an accusation that Maté denies vigorously. I am not weighing in on that. I have not reviewed their coverage extensively. What I can say is that whatever case you might try to mount about Aaron Maté, I just don't know how you can make the same argument about a journalist from the very mainstream Globe and Mail. But as you are about to hear, Ukraine did just that. Anton Skiba is a Ukrainian photojournalist and reporter who has covered Ukraine since 2014 for many international news outlets. He's been working for the Globe and Mail in Ukraine since 2022, starting a month before the Russian invasion. Skiba was recently nominated for a National Newspaper Award for his coverage of the war in Ukraine. He's also been interrogated twice by Ukrainian security officials. He's been accused of holding a Russian passport, and he's been asked to take a lie detector test by those same Ukrainian security officials. Reporter Sarah Larniuk spoke with Skiba for Canada Land in Kyiv. In discussing his interrogations, he told her that his interrogators were focused on whether or not his journalism, in their opinion, served Ukraine's national interests.
The most recurring phrase was that the officer told me, who interrogated me, he told me, like, I don't see you as an enemy, but I have doubts that your work is aligned with national interests of Ukraine. Like, what does it mean, serving to the national interest at all? So it's very hard to divide my personal feelings on that and my professional feelings on that. Because, like, from professional point of view, it's a pure establishing of the control over the job I'm doing. And so if he's trying to model the situation, okay, if my job is not aligned to national interests of Ukraine, so does it mean that I can't do journalism here? For me, it's clear that now Ukraine is doing whatever to win this war. So, and that's why they're trying to fight enemy on any battlefield as possible, not only physical battlefield, but informational warfare, etc. And there's a lot of Russian disinformation here, and Russian propaganda, and Russian narratives, which is trying to penetrate through Ukrainian communication field. However, asking professional journalists about serving to national interests, it's probably the most stupid thing they could ever ask. Because, still, even professional journalists, they do not serve to the government of Ukraine. They serve to Ukrainian society. As a Ukrainian journalist, I'm working for the society, for public interest, but not for the government interest.
Well, and I mean, there are some inherent, like, rules that we do follow to get the accreditation, like you won't report on where a missile strike is exactly or if it's hitting the
embargoes.
Exactly.
I really support the separation of security rules, when means you about undisclosure, like certain facts about army and like their location. I'm absolutely fine with that, because it's not okay if the journalism harms like army or civilians or whatever, because our main principle do not to harm, but to tell the story. However, talks about national interests, very, very vague definition, and the government could put whatever they want into this definition. For me, it's like it's the biggest concern in the story. Because, like, and it's clear that now, within a time, the government of Ukraine, they also see informational sphere as a part of the warfare, and they fighting in this sphere. They are also trying to establish more and more control here in this field as well among the journalists. And we hear all the stories like when journalists reported something bad or that the government didn't like, and they suspend accreditation, they strip accreditation. It shouldn't be in this way. The journalist's job is very clear. It's just to report what you see and to fact check. and to verify to your audience is this information legit or not. Ukraine is very hostile and hazardous environment. So all those Ukrainian journalists who are fighting here for media rights, they are like heroes. They are double heroes because from one side they report war crimes committed by Russia, but from other side they are trying to build better environment here. So that's why I'm concerned and I insist that media freedom should be in attention of our Western partners and countries. And it never should be put out from the agenda, at least till the end of the war. It just should be always underlined whatever is going on in the country. Because it's just during martial law, it's like media freedom is the first thing which would be the easiest thing to crack down.
Are you more widely concerned about press freedom in Ukraine? Like, is that...
Yeah. I clearly understand now we are in martial law. And like, the challenge Ukraine is facing right now is the biggest conflict since World War II in Europe by scale and by amount of tragedy and drama. And like, my main concern is that it's not the only war which Ukraine has. Another war which Ukraine has is a war for democracy. And very important to remember about this war for democracy because Ukraine is not sustained and developed democracy as it been perceived in the Western countries, because it's still the country in transit. Like, 9 years ago, people, like, I don't know, a few hundred meters from here, were fighting against dictatorship who were building authoritarian state and then escaped to Russia. And, like, Ukraine started to reform itself after that. And for 9 years, a lot of reforms simply hasn't finished yet. And if we are talking about fight corruption, media freedom, like, I don't know, law enforcement, like, et cetera, Ukraine is still the country in transit who is facing the hugest challenge to fight for its existence. But in the meantime, Ukraine should fight for the democracy inside. And the media freedom is one of these aspects. And also the governmental control over media doesn't help.
We wanted to know what Ukraine had to say about all this. And thanks to reporter Sarah Larniuk, we were able to submit questions in Ukrainian, which they answered in Ukrainian, from two ministries, the Ministry of Culture and the Ministry of Defense, respectively. These responses have been translated, and I'm going to share with you from those responses now. We asked Ukraine, what is the government's response to these restrictions on press freedom? The Ministry of Culture answered, "We must emphasize that Russian propaganda is based on methods known since the Second World War, which were used by Goebbels and other war criminals. However, Russian propaganda multiplied this entire arsenal with enormous funds, and this is a very scary weapon. The international field has been under the pressure of racist propaganda, which updates the media arsenal to plant the Kremlin discourse, covers like an octopus different corners of the world, and constantly mimics and is reborn under new names." They went on to say that despite their admitted semi-censorship due to the war, which they say justifies bans on the distribution of certain types of information, Ukraine still remains one of the positive leaders of Europe and the world in the context of freedom of speech. We went on to ask Ukrainian officials about specific cases, about the Globe and Mail reporter who was initially denied an extension of his press credentials, and about other reporters who seemed to face similar retaliations for the nature of their reporting. "The above described cases are not known to the Ministry of Culture," said the Ministry of Culture. But we got a bit more detail from the Ministry of Defense. Here's what they said. "It should be noted that the armed forces of Ukraine do not censor journalistic materials and do not try to influence their content by canceling, suspending accreditation, as this is prohibited by the current legislation of Ukraine. As of today, 7 people were refused. The reasons for this are the inconsistency of the information provided, the existence of reasons to consider the granting of accreditation to a media representative inappropriate, cases of cancellation in the past, or the recommendation of the Security Service of Ukraine. Such a refusal may be made without explaining the reasons for the refusal. That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Additional reporting today from Sarah Larniuk. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Additional production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Welcome, Karen. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Karen Pugliese, former news boss at APTN, Nieman Fellow at Harvard, professor at TMU, managing editor of investigations at CBC, editor of Canada's National Observer, and now editor-in-chief of Canada Land. Welcome back to Shortcuts.
Thank you, Jonathan. I was thinking this is our first Shortcuts together.
It is our first Shortcuts together, yes. Today on the show, the Canadian government has had it up to here with oligopolies, American ones, that is, not any of the many Canadian ones. And the first woman to head up the Assembly of First Nations is out after just 2 years due to some combination of any or all of her own alleged misconduct, a conspiracy to depose her, and or run-of-the-mill misogyny. I'm Jonathan Goldsby, and this is Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Finding out what's happening in your community could soon get a little harder.
Canadian news could soon disappear from Canadians' Google searches and their Facebook and Instagram feeds. It's in response to Bill C-18 recently passed,
which will force tech giants to cut deals with media publishers for sharing and directing users to online news content.
When the government's Online News Act takes effect at the end of the year.
One upside to following the Canadian government's ongoing battle, the tech giants, is that we finally get to feel like we're living in the future. Like a semi-dystopian future, mind you, but it's still fun to imagine each news lead as the opening crawl of a mid-budget 1990s techno thriller with glowing blocky letters set against a hazy orange cityscape. In the year 2023, two corporations, Google and Meta, control what can be seen on the internet. The taxation of hyperlinks to news stories is in dispute. Hoping to resolve the matter with an information blockade, the tech oligopoly has stopped all posting to Canadian news sites. Okay, I actually just started stealing from the Phantom Menace there. That's pretty close to the actual opening crawl. Bill C-18, the Online News Act, became law on June 22nd. That's the one that would force Google and Meta to pay news businesses for the privilege of displaying links to their content. But even though it's now law, it doesn't actually come into effect for at least another several months as the government and the CRTC, that's the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, sort out the details of how it will actually be implemented. And that's afforded Google and Meta a new window in which to ratchet up their pressure tactics, the latest escalation of which has seen Google say that they're not only going to keep Canadian outlets out of Google News, but to de-index them from search results entirely. Like their FAQ, but this actually has a question, how will Canadians get timely access to local news and information from Canadian publications? Offering the answer, well, Canadians will continue to be able to access all news sites by typing the outlet's web address directly into their browser, or through apps, newsletters, aggregators, and other channels. Which is sort of like saying, well, all household plumbing is being eliminated, but don't worry, you can still trudge over to the neighborhood well. So Karen, we've talked a lot about C-18 on the show, or, well, this show has talked a lot about C-18. I've never actually had the opportunity. I'm not actually sure if you have either. What take could we offer that would irritate Jesse the most?
Oh my God. Well, I sit beside him now, so I just irritate him all day long. You know, I think that Jesse and I see this differently in some ways. Both of us do not like C-18. I mean, I think that that's fair to say. To begin with, it's a law that had, to me, some semblance of sense from it. Not the way that Jesse kind of describes it that, which is also, like, more than one thing can be true.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse describes it as it was trying to resolve the fact that Google and Facebook were just better at selling ads, and this was seen as taking ads away from the media, and damn it, that was their money, and give it back. I saw it a little differently because I come from broadcasting, and particularly worked at APTN, which was a must-carry and a must-pay. So for people who don't know, the CRTC can force cable companies to carry certain stations and make them pay so much on the cable dollar for that content. If cable has no content on it, why would you have cable, right? And then privates, if it's not mandated to carry, then they just negotiate by themselves. So this is very similar to like what people are trying to do with news on these new platforms. And there's a logic there that makes sense. If the platforms are benefiting from having news, maybe they should negotiate this. But, I mean, the bill's whack. I mean, like, I just don't know. Like, it doesn't translate well. And I just don't know how you would actually execute this messy thing.
It is a very messy thing. Senator Paula Simons likes to call it a Rube Goldberg device of a subsidy machine. And that's kind of what it is. Well, researching this, what I figured out was, so, I mean, the few obvious questions. One is, if the point is to rebalance the wealth between Facebook and Google and news publishers to say that, okay, regardless of why or how, these companies have all of this money and they're getting richer and richer, and news companies have less and less money and they're falling apart, what can we do to shift some of that wealth over? Well, the most obvious thing would be a tax of some sort. And I mean, obviously, you know, a tax of some sort, then, you know, the government could fund news directly, and people would still, a lot of the same people who object to this would still object to government funding news. But what I realized, or what I discovered, is like, okay, Australia, this is all modeled, of course, on Australia's news media bargaining code. Before they got to the news media bargaining code, what their idea was a tax. And the reason they backed off on it was because this was in 2018, and the Trump administration signaled that that would basically start a trade war with the United States. Hence coming up with this, basically, this Rube Goldberg device of a subsidy machine to try to accomplish this in a sort of sideways manner. And the remarkable thing is that it seems to have worked in Australia, but only kind of just barely. A lot of what's given the Canadian government confidence to sort of keep going with this, to keep charging forward, has been, and they keep pointing at, like, well, it worked in Australia, it worked in Australia, it worked in Australia. And I mean, that's what the minister's default line has been. One of the people who was in charge of there, Rod Sims, he was the head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission in that whole period, retired from it last year, is now a professor at the Australian National University, has been cheering on Canada in this fight. He spoke at the House of Commons, he spoke at the Senate, he's written op-eds on it. And at the Senate, at a Senate committee hearing at the end of May, he was specifically asked, like, what does he make of these threats? And here's what he said.
When Google threatened to move search out of Australia and Facebook threatened to take all news and emergency advice off their platform, there was a large pushback from the Australian population that this was Google and Facebook being disrespectful to Australia and disrespectful to Australian politicians. So I think there is an underlying democratic issue there. I should just add that, I mean, it's very hard for Google to take search out of Australia, and I think it's extremely hard of Google to take search out of Canada. If it left one major country, such as Canada, and a new competitor was allowed in, I think that's a big threat to Google. So it's not clear to me that Google were ever going to carry out the threat in Australia. I suspect not in Canada.
So in Australia, Google was threatening to pull out entirely. Here, it seems like they're being a little smarter by just threatening to take news out of it in a way that a lot of people probably wouldn't notice. What is the proper reaction? Is it the we don't negotiate with terrorist type of approach that I think the federal government is about to deliver? Or is it to say, like, this law does have some fundamental issues, maybe we should revisit it?
I think both things are true. I mean, well, first of all, just on the Australia point, remember when they cancelled news, they cancelled news very broadly.
Oh, when Facebook.
Yeah, when Facebook did. Big public pushback. And they'd actually accidentally cancelled some health sites and other things. Mm-hmm. The pandemic was still going on. So I think that kind of helped. And we're not in necessarily that situation in Canada. But having said that, I mean, first of all, everybody knows the bill is very unwieldy, like this link tax idea, and somebody has to sort out which links actually belong to quote-unquote news and which links are just logs and how much money you get. Like, it's just, it looks like a crazy bureaucratic nightmare. But